Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And my guest today for the third time in a few weeks is my friend Jeffrey Mason, spelled M-A-S-S-O-N. Jeff's a PhD, I think, in Sanskrit or in some ancient languages of India. He can tell us more about that. Jeff was the head of the Freud Archives and a psychoanalyst before he discovered that Freud's letters confirmed that Freud knew that the women he was seeing were victims of sexual abuse, but that when he brought this up in public, it caused so much rejection from within the medical community with which he still identified that he gave up his theory that these women were being sexually abused, and that's what these memories of sexual abuse were about, and changed it to, now they fantasized it, fathers and mothers and uncles and big brothers and so on would never do things like that. And he became rich and famous, or at least famous, in part because of a huge betrayal of the untold millions of human beings that are sexually abused throughout the world every day, starting as children. We're doing a series. This has turned out to be a series. Jeffrey is a man of such wide interests and learning, and also has interests that just so closely correspond with mine in many areas that I'm just finding it very worthwhile interviewing him, kind of making an archive right now of myself interviewing Jeffrey Mason. Our first show, oh, and by the way, he's my only friend who's written more books than I have. I think that's right, Jeff. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I think you're my only...
I've published 29 books.
yeah, you're ahead of me by 4 or 5 at this point. But the first show we did together was on Jeffrey's favorite topic, in which he's written many, many books, which is the subject of animals, animal rights. It blends into Jeffrey's ideas about not eating animals. It's a profound interest of his. It reflects his newest book, which is Beasts: What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. I own more books by Jeffrey than by any other author other than myself, including some of my favorite books, When Elephants Weep, Dogs Never Lie About Love, the Dog Who Couldn't Stop Loving. So that was our first show, and we talked some about evolution in that first show, another common interest. In our second show, we talked about Freud's betrayal that I mentioned earlier, and Jeffrey's book about that, which is, again, an important book, The Assault on Truth, one of the books in my library. And this week, we're going to talk about something that Jeffrey and I, on and off, thought about writing a book together about, but it never happened. And it's the subject of Nazi Germany and how psychiatry led the way in the creation of the Holocaust by basically proving you could do a bureaucratic, heavily organized murder program, including gas chambers with soap disguised, wooden soap, including cremating the bodies, although not with the technology that was used in the Holocaust. Basically, in many ways, psychiatry just set up the whole beginning of the Holocaust. Now, if you think I'm exaggerating, I could tell you that if you read my article, it's on my website. You can find it under my scientific articles on the murder of mental patients, that at the doctor's trial at Nuremberg, several different observers concluded that the Holocaust could not have occurred had the organization of psychiatry, beginning before Hitler took power, had not developed the ideas of euthanasia and of medical murder, and without Hitler even being involved, as far as we know, if they hadn't started a murder program as soon as Hitler took power. And I'm just going to briefly mention their names, and then maybe Jeff and I can talk about how we originally got interested in this. I'd be interested in how Jeffrey got interested in it. He and I actually went to Germany and gave lectures on this subject at the conference in Germany on medicine in the Third Reich. But anyway, Andrew Ivey, who was our AMA representative, basically said that psychiatry was the entering wedge to the Holocaust and that the Holocaust probably couldn't have happened without it. Two Germans, one of whom later committed suicide, with two doctors whose names Jeffrey can tell you when I finally give them the mic and pronounce correctly for you, they both wrote a book concluding that the Holocaust would not have occurred except for psychiatry's proving it could be done and showing that no one would protest. And finally, even our Nuremberg psychiatrist, who was himself very pro-biological psychiatry, who himself had praised Hitler's mental hygiene program, and he himself also said, and this is all quoted in my article, that the entering wedge for the Holocaust was organized psychiatry's murder program. I'm going to take a deep breath and hand the mic over to Jeffrey, figuratively, who's in Spain. Jeff.
Thank you, Peter. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You know, I was thinking about how you and I'm not sure what the date was when we went together to Germany, but it was before the wall came down because we went into Eastern Germany, if you remember.
And oh, do
that was
I ever.
Quite a, yeah, that was an amazing experience. Very unpleasant and very awful. You remember those young teenage girls who begged us to take them back, pretend they were our assistants or something, and we realized we couldn't get away with that. But I was thinking about the conference we attended there, very small conference with practically nobody in the audience. And the person that organized it is the wonderful Benno Müller-Hill. And he was chairman of the Department of Genetics at the University of Cologne. And he organized this conference, invited Peter and me to come. I talked about Jung and his anti-Semitism. We may get to that. But what struck me about it is we were able, Peter and I, to meet two legendary figures from the time of the Holocaust. One was Rudolf Werber. And Werber, who died in 2006, is the man who did the 40-page report on Auschwitz. He escaped Auschwitz in 1944, and he brought to the West the first absolutely foolproof, full report on what was taking place there. And you can read about it if you put his name into Google and Wikipedia, you'll see fascinating articles about him. He wrote a book called I Cannot Forgive, which I liked about him. He was like that. He later called it Escape from Auschwitz, very much to be recommended. And he was a dynamite person. And when I gave my talk on Jung, he came up to me and said, I'm so glad that somebody at last has talked about his anti-Semitism, what a vile man he was. And I totally agree. And the other person we met there, Peter, I don't know if you remember, but there was a very distinguished, very elderly man who actually died shortly thereafter by the name of Hermann Langbein. And he was one of the few Germans who was made a righteous among the nations by Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, because he saved so many Jews when he was a prisoner in Auschwitz. He was an Austrian who came to Spain, where I am now, to Malaga, to fight for the Republicans during the Spanish Civil War. And when Franco won that war, he was taken prisoner in France. And when France was taken over by the Germans sent him to various concentration camps, and he wound up at Auschwitz. He was not Jewish. And he was an extraordinary human being. I'm so glad we got to meet him, Peter. You know, if you go now to Germany, you can't meet any more survivors of the Holocaust. It's too late. They're all dead, or there may be a few in their late 90s, but we were very lucky to go when we did. So, and your article, Peter, 1993, the article that you talked about, I still consider it one of the best articles on this topic, and not just because you give a good overview, and not just because you were probably the only psychiatrist who was willing to take a stand and say, look, psychiatry is guilty here. There's no two ways about it. Psychiatry was heavily involved in the killing of mental patients, and we in Germany. And we have to ask ourselves why. What is it about psychiatry that allows itself to lend itself to that kind of depravity? I mean, it's true that medical science in general, doctors were highly represented among Nazis in Germany. But more than any other field, it was psychiatry. And psychiatry is the field that got most involved in the actual killing of mental patients. So your article in 1993 was a very powerful. And you give there a document. I reread it tonight because I knew we were going to talk. And once again, I was blown away by something at the very beginning that I don't think anybody else has ever commented upon, namely that after the war was over in Austria, there was an asylum that continued to kill patients under the disguise of euthanasia, and that it was an American soldier who actually stopped it and gave you, I believe, well, you can tell us, Peter, I think he gave you some pages that he wrote about this, 10 pages. I think his name was Abrams. Can you tell us
Abrams.
About that? It was absolutely Abrams. That was absolutely fascinating, Peter.
Well, I heard about him when I was doing a radio show in the early 70s, I think on Pacifica, WBAI in New York. And I mentioned that I'd read Hannah Arendt, and Hannah Arendt had talked about this murder program. She really glosses it over. She said that they killed something like 20,000 German mental patients or something like that. And then we got, during the phone calls into the show, Abrams called and said, you know, doctor, people think you exaggerate, but actually this situation is much, much worse. It was over 100,000 mental patients that were killed in Germany by the psychiatrists, and then a lot more throughout Europe. And he said, I liberated a camp. I was a 20-year-old soldier, and my job was public relations with the occupied part of Germany that we were in possession of while the war was still going on. And a Wehrmacht doctor came to us and said he'd just, you know, been decommissioned or surrendered or whatever. He'd returned home and found they were killing mental patients at his local state hospital in Kaufbeuren. That was the name of the hospital, Kaufbeuren. And that he wanted us to stop it. And so Abrams and his assistant, both kids, took a Tommy gun and went to the hospital. And as soon as they got there, the psychiatrist in charge hung himself. This was a hospital run by some sort of religious order. They had were poisoning and starving their patients to death. They had crematorium. They had ovens, several ovens, in which they then tried to get rid of the evidence. Abrams described how brutalized these people were, that it was basically an extermination camp, and he found material indicating that this was going on elsewhere. He had numbers concerning how many were killed at Kafburin, and he handed all of that over to the army, and I think it went to the became a part of the Nuremberg trials. But he also sent me a report he had written about all of this. And, Jeffrey, he sent me photos. And those photos, under circumstances that are unusual, were eventually destroyed. I had these photos. And I lent them to somebody to use for media, and they claimed they were destroyed. And I published them in one magazine article, and they were of the doctor who hung himself hanging, and there were pictures also of the emaciated dying inmates and also of the nurses who he forced to stand up in front of the crematoriums. And this murder program was so much a part of psychiatry that it went on literally after the war. Was lost in certain, was over in certain areas. And of course, as you know as well as I, psychiatrists were beginning to plan this program in 1920 before the Hitler came to power. And as soon as Hitler came to power, we have nothing to show, as far as I know, that Hitler promoted this program. They began this wide-scale program with doctors in Berlin filling out euthanasia forms, and then the patients who were would actually approve the euthanasia forms that were filled out in local hospitals for the chronically ill, the mentally ill, for the chronically ill children. If one doctor agreed, then the murders would take place. They were sent on trains to four or five killing centers, Hartheim, Hadamar, places people haven't heard of. And this was an organized program before Hitler got involved. And after Hitler was booed at a truck stop for this program, and it may have been at Kafburin, the only known opposition ever to Hitler that was active was around the euthanasia program. I think some medical students got beheaded for opposing it, and I think that's the total opposition. And then Hitler stopped the program, and he used the doctors from the program to man Stengel, to man the first Holocaust extermination center. They used the euthanasia forms in very early in the in this program in the Holocaust. You know, they'd write Jewish or communist on it, or enemy of the people or something like that. And the equipment from the dismantled programs was sent to Poland for the extermination centers there. And one I don't remember the name of it. And then I'm gonna hand it back to you. But one of the extermination centers actually began to function because Hitler stopped the euthanasia, the medical murder program, and it was simply, I think, was dismantled and shipped to the East again to become part of the Holocaust. So this is really an intimate relationship between the psychiatric Holocaust and then the Holocaust, the larger Holocaust of Jews and gypsies and homosexuals and other people who got caught in Hitler's trap. Wow, I didn't expect to say all that, Jeff. It's all from the top of my head.
Well, you know, it's terribly interesting, Peter. I wanted to ask you, because in reading your article, I realized you do talk a lot about parallels in America. that a lot of the ideas, certainly, I mean, it started with sterilization in Germany. And but it wasn't only Germany. Sweden was sterilizing quite a few people. California, as you point out, sterilized a lot of people. And there were psychiatrists in America who wanted to kill mental patients, who saw no problem with that. And my question to you is, why is it that it only happened in Germany? That you know, that's something that's always made me wonder. Why was it so easy to do this in Germany? They had problems when they were doing it with children. That's when people protested, because, of course, a lot of these families didn't want their children killed, and they didn't understand. Some of them went along with it, but most of them were just fooled by the authorities. The psychiatrists would write a letter and say, unfortunately, your child died of pneumonia. And or in one case, and that's how it got out, they said he died of a ruptured appendix. And the parents said, wait a minute, his appendix had already been removed years before. So they investigated, and then this began to become known to the German population. And it was the only time they stood up to Hitler, and they said, stop it. And he did stop it, which shows you that had the German population not wanted Hitler to kill Jews, he probably wouldn't have been able to. At the very most, they were indifferent. They just didn't care, whereas they did care about the killing of their own children. So my question to you, Peter, which I don't have an answer for, is why is it that in Germany, psychiatrists were not only willing to go along with this, they were enthusiastic about it. As far as I know, there was only one single psychiatrist about whom almost nothing is known except his name, Ewing, E-W-I-N-G, is the only psychiatrist I know who absolutely refused and walked out on it. But everyone else
I heard,
went along.
Jeff, what I heard was that Ewing had a crippled leg, that he had some sort of a chronic problem, and that it had a limp or something, and that maybe that helped him identify with these people. But, you know, there were also the story of three medical students protested and were beheaded. I don't know if that's a true story or not.
Well, that was the Sophie Scholl. They were wonderful. They were philosophy students at the University of Munich. It's called the White Rose. It's an amazing, it's a beautiful movie about, and very, very, and there, you know, several books written about them. There's a brother and a sister and the professor of philosophy, and they protested. All they did was send out leaflets, and they were beheaded in the most horrible way in Munich. But I don't think there were any medical students who protested.
All right, that's
now,
a mixed
after
memory.
The war, yeah, after the
Makes
war, of
sense.
Course, you had that book. You had that book that you mentioned by Mitscherlich when he was a medical student. But you know the interesting thing. The Americans asked him to write that book about the killings of mental patients by Mitscherlich, who became a very famous psychoanalyst in Germany, both he and his wife. But when that book was published in Germany, the German Medical Society, after the war, bought up all the copies and pulped them. They did not want that known. And his career... He and a medical student did this. He had just finished medicine. He became a psychiatrist himself, but he had just finished a medical school, and he wrote it with a man by the name of Milke, who was a medical student. And the two of them together were almost destroyed in their careers. That's interesting, because I bet you remember, Peter, that when we were in Germany so many years later, and we were, when was that, in 87 or 88, something around there. And we were with Benno Müller-Hill, and Benno Müller-Hill told us that he was called a Nestbeschmutzer, which is a German term, an awful German term for meaning a somebody who dirties your own nest. In other words, because he had written this fantastic and wonderful book called Murderous Science, that in my opinion is the best book. It's a very, very short book, translated into English as Murderous Science. And he really called it. He was an incredibly learned man, a wonderful man, and he paid the price too in the 80s. That book was published in 1984 in German and was never reissued. And he told you and me in his living room that his colleagues turned their back on him and wanted nothing to do with him. Do you remember that, Peter?
Not so much of the detail as you do, probably because you were partly speaking in German, is my guess, when you were talking with him with me. Let me catch up on a couple.
No, he spoke very good English.
My memory for those conversations.
He'd worked with James
not
Watson
as clear as yours.
In Cold Harbor. Yeah. Okay. He was an extraordinary man, unfortunately. Yeah.
Let me address a couple of things you brought up. First of all, the conference was in 1988.
And it was, of course, Cologne.
I remembered more than a few people. I thought there were a couple hundred people there, but maybe not. The title of my article, folks, is Psychiatry's Role in the Holocaust. If you go to my website, I'll tell you a little later how to find it on the website, but it's among my, let's just go back, scroll down to 1988 in my articles, my general list of articles on the website to 1988, you'll get psychiatry's role in the Holocaust. The other thing I checked was you mentioned, Jeffrey, that American, and then I'm going to try to answer your question, that American psychiatrists had talked about killing mental patients. And in fact, in 1942, there was a debate at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association between a neurologist and a psychiatrist on the issue of should children who were retarded at the age of five, should they be either sterilized or, quote, euthanized? They weren't even saying treated, taken care of, coddled, loved. They said the only debate was should they be sterilized or should they be murdered. And then in 1942, the same year, the American Journal of Psychiatry did an editorial in which it formally sided with the concept of murdering five-year-old retarded children. It said that one of the big issues would be getting the parents over their guilt about murdering the children. And I had the article a minute ago. The actual reference to it, but I'll have that in a minute. Here it is. It's the title of the article is Euthanasia. It's in the American Journal of Psychiatry, 1942, volume 99, page 141 to 143. So the answer to this partly is that I think that it would have happened in America if psychiatry could have. Now, why couldn't psychiatry? And one of the reasons, I think the most basic reason is we didn't have a Führer. Because Hitler was praised throughout the mental health community of the Western world as the first mental hygiene head of a country, because he had written in Mein Kampf and other places, I guess Mein Kampf, maybe only Mein Kampf, about need to sterilize people who were had hereditary illnesses, the mentally ill, the epileptics.
And he had his personal doctor, Karl Brandt. He told him in 1939, I want you to start killing mental patients now. And he called them, a term very common at the time, useless eaters. And Hitler said, I want children with Down syndrome, any malformation, and including delinquents, I want them killed. And when Karl Brandt was put in charge of this, when they started using gas to kill adults, he said, and I quote him here, this is a major advance in medical history. And I'm glad to know that at Nuremberg, he not only was found guilty, he was hanged.
Now, and, Jeffrey, you know, this I'm is not new a great, to me. Yeah. I didn't know that Hitler in 39, that we had evidence that he was behind the murder of mental patients or supporting it. So this
absolutely. Yeah, no, it was his idea. What he used the book that you were talking about, the book of 1920 by Binding and Hawk. And that book was the first book to talk about, the German term's amazing, it's called Lebensunwertes Leben, a life that is not worth living. And every time I hear that phrase, Peter, it just drives me insane. I can't stand to hear it. And you know, I had a terrible argument with a friend of mine, whom you will know and recognize, considered the world's most influential philosopher, and that's Peter Singer. And he and I share one thing in common, our concern for animals, but we diverge on a very important issue, and that's euthanasia. And not just euthanasia, but he's famous also for writing a terrible book called Should This Child Live? And the implicit answer is no. And in that book, I was shocked to see that he uses the term life not worth living. So I called him and I said, Peter, this is not you, Peter, this is Peter Singer. You would never make such a comment. And I said, Peter, are you aware of the fact that that term was used in Nazi Germany to justify the killing of mental patients? And he said, yes, I'm aware of that, but it's still a good term. And I thought, you know, I have nothing more to say to you if you can justify that. I mean, first of all, in whose eyes is the life not worth living?
Well, we know, of course. You know, listen, Jeffrey, for the first time in my career, I've run over my half-hour break because I'm so involved in listening and talking with you. Okay. We should be going to break now. It's 4:33. And when we come back, we will continue with this amazing documentation that is so little available out there about what happened in Nazi Germany with psychiatry. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin in one of the, I think, most important radio shows you'll ever hear. It's actually the third in a series I'm doing with Jeffrey Mason, my friend, and a man of broad interest, and a real truth seeker, a real genuine seeker of truth. And I'm thinking that I'm going to do at least one more show, which will be on his views that psychotherapy is really not even possible and is very corrupt in its approach to things. Maybe Jeffrey will say one sentence about that. But it'd be interesting because, you know, I'm a psychotherapist, but I also have many, many questions about the whole idea and profession of psychotherapy. I think it needs to be looked at. So I may have Jeffrey come and talk for an hour with me about something that we have a lot of disagreement about. I don't know if I have the courage to have Jeffrey come on for a fifth show to talk about my biggest moral failing, which is eating animals. Jeffrey does not eat animals or anything that has anything to do with animals. So, Jeff, you wanted to pick up on Robert Lifton. Why don't you talk about that
a little bit and maybe I'll chime in? You know, I want to pick up when you said that, you know, this is not a very well-known topic in America. You're 100% correct. And I've been wondering why that is. Part of the reason is that, in my opinion, the best book ever written about it is by Benno Müller-Hill, and that was just ignored. And secondly, there was also a self-published book that you probably know more about than I do. It was one of the first books I read about it. I thought it was a terrific book. It's called Murderers in White Coats, and it's by a man whom I never met called Lenny Lapin, who was a psychiatric patient, a survivor of psychiatry. And you probably know him, but he self-published this book, and it was a long time ago, and it was very, very good. I think it's the first thing I read about this topic. But then the most popular book, the only book possibly that anyone in America knows about the killing of mental patients, is a book by Robert Lifton, the acclaimed psychiatrist, who wrote a wonderful book about Hiroshima, but a terrible book about the killing of mental patients. And it's called The Nazi Doctors. And it's constantly referred to. It's considered a, quote, classic. I've read it twice now, very carefully. And, Peter, I just can't bear that book. And there are many, many reasons for that. But one of the most, and I saw when reading your article, I was worried when I reread your article today, I saw you refer to Robert Lifton's book. And I said, oh, no, I hope Peter's not going to praise it. And by God, you did not. You honed in on exactly what bothered me. Well, there are many, many things, of course. I could talk for hours, but I won't. But the one thing that bothered me the most is something that bothered you. And I'll let you tell it if you wish, Peter. And that's about the giving of electroshock. Do you remember that passage?
Yes. Well, I think there were two things that bothered me about the book. I think on a much more important and broader level, what bothered me was the very title, Nazi Doctors. These were plain old psychiatrists, folks. These were the heads of psychiatry throughout all of Germany, professors, all of whom were part of this organization of the so-called the euthanasia program, which was the murder program of mental patients, and also all kinds of other chronically ill people. I think they excluded Jews as unworthy, didn't they, Jeff?
They did eventually kill Jews. But Peter, pointed out something very important, that he doesn't even mention the fact that many of these psychiatrists went on to continue in their profession the war. So he was trying to whitewash psychiatry.
Yeah, by calling it a Nazi program. But the other thing was the shock treatment. You know, folks, one of the things I've never been able to fully grok, to use the old 60s concept, was how psychiatry so strongly supports shock treatment. And Lifton, being a psychiatrist, says, well, some good things came out of the German psychiatry research programs in the extermination camps. They did good research on shock treatment and showed how it could be helpful to people who got depressed. I mean, how disgusting. Liberal American psychiatrist.
It's even worse than that, because what he did, Lifton, is he said that there were times in the camps. First of all, he has this despicable phrase, a human being in a Nazi uniform. So he's talking about a doctor in Auschwitz. And he said, and how does he prove that he was, quote, a human being? Because he was friendly with a Jewish doctor from Poland, because the two of them shared an interest in electroshock, and they would go around the camp and they would administer electroshock to patients. And this showed, A, that he had respect for the patients and wanted to help them overcome their depression before they were murdered, and B, that he had a collegial feeling for this Jewish psychiatrist who also liked giving electroshock. I just found that utterly despicable. I mean, that's exhibit A for me in this man being should be sent to prison.
You know, thinking more, Jeff, too, about why not in America. You know, my article that you've been kind in praising, I tried to get that published non-medically in magazines in the U.S., before I went to Germany and gave the talk. I had this manuscript for a long time, and no one would take it in the U.S. And then I sent it to the Jewish intellectual magazine, Common
Commentary, what is it? Yeah.
Commentary. Is that it? Is that what?
Yeah.
And they wrote back to me that it would distract from the Holocaust to publish it. And
that's ridiculous.
It was just bizarre. And it's so ironic that it finally got published in a respected international medical journal after the conference. But that was years of trying to get that published. And I think the article was the first thing in English ever published by an American, that dealt with this. And I did get it published finally in a popular magazine. And I think it was the first time that ever happened in America, too. And this, again, still so little about it, as you said.
Well, now,
let me ask you,
Peter, you've been in touch with a lot of American psychiatrists. Have any of them taken a stance about what happened? I mean, I'm not a great fan of Thomas Szasz, but I can't remember seeing anything in his works where he tackled this. I could be wrong. You knew him better than me. Were there other psychiatrists who were willing to talk about this and write about it? I'm not aware of that.
No, I'm not aware of anyone having written about it. I certainly never got any comments from Tom Szasz about what a great piece of work it was. And at that time, Szasz and I he was still talking to me. Eventually, he stopped talking to me. And I think that the issue for Szasz is he did not want to be a humanitarian. He just wanted to be a libertarian. So all his writing is about leave me alone, and whatever happens to other people happens to other people. And he profoundly resented, for example, my trying to abolish lobotomy. He actually wrote a footnote somewhere. Yeah, he wrote a footnote somewhere, meaning me, that people who want to outlaw lobotomy are worse than lobotomists because people should have the freedom to get whatever they want.
Oh, free choice. I remember seeing that. I got into a terrible argument with Leonard Frank. We almost stopped speaking to each other over that because, you know, he was a great admirer of Thomas Szasz. And when I pointed that out, I said, look, this is an attack on Bregan as one of the best things that Bregan ever did. I mean, of course it should be outlawed. I mean,
I never got it outlawed.
Brain,
I did stop most of it, Jeff. I didn't never got it outlawed.
Yeah, but
I did stop most of it.
No, but what I meant was, what would be wrong with outlawing that? What's wrong with that? And Szasz made that idiotic comment that's as bad as lobotomy or something.
No, I was personal lobotomist for wanting to outlaw it. But
yeah,
I don't want to get a lot of
interest.
That would be another show, yeah?
That would be another show, yeah. But it's interesting that there were so few, if any, psychiatrists, even in other countries. You see, that's what always got to me. There were, as far as I know, almost none in Germany. There may have been one or two recently. But certainly when we were there, nobody. And I remember you and I talking to some of the researchers, and they even backed away from us the minute we wanted to bring up what is it about psychiatry that lends itself to this kind of abuse. They basically wanted to stop talking to us. They could not handle that.
Yeah, I remember that.
I found that was true in Italy. It was true in France. And it's just, and it's, I think it was true in America too. I don't think there were many psychiatrists who wanted to think about this. And at the most, they were willing to say, okay, the Germans did this, but it could never happen anywhere else. Well, it did to a much more limited extent. It did happen in France. And I don't know enough about Italian psychiatry, but I wouldn't be surprised if it happened in Italy and in Spain and possibly other countries. You know, it's that people shy away, even researchers shy away from doing this kind of research, because it's not good for their careers.
You know, in the article, I try to summarize what I think are the basic issues in psychiatry that lead to this. I think, first of all, that, and I'll just do this very briefly, but first of all, psychiatry has been built on damaging people from its very beginning. So from the very onset, you have these psychiatry, which is in the state mental hospitals. You have a profession that locks up people and damages them. And then in the 30s, it begins to damage brains. It does lobotomy and electroshock. And that's not a big step away from euthanasia. To think that a solution is to slice up somebody's brain to have so they have less feeling in humanity, to me, is kind of, perpetrating a walking euthanasia, though those people are still people.
Absolutely.
Really mutilated them so badly, or at least the expression of their souls has been terribly mutilated. So psychiatry has a long, long history of fundamentally attacking human beings, and since the 30s, fundamentally attacking the human brain and damaging it. Another concept, I think, is that psychiatry objectifies people. It, instead of seeing people as people, it sees them as diseases from the medical approach. And I think that once you objectify a human being and see them as somehow fundamentally different from you because they are diseased in some way, I think that you end up hating and wanting to destroy. I think there's no neutrality on human beings. We can't be objective. We can't treat them from a neutral position. We're either going to love them or hate them, our fellow human beings. And if we try to treat them objectively, we end up hating them. We just don't have an objective stance to take it with human beings. So that was a kind of two of the ideas. But I think there's a basic underlying moral flaws in psychiatry that make it susceptible to eugenics and sterilization, which was done massively in the U.S. And as you know, our eugenicists went to Germany in the late 30s and told Hitler he'd be able to get away with mass sterilization because they'd been getting away with it in the U.S. I think it was Paul Popenoe who was one of the big figures in the California sterilization program. He went over and he talked to the Germans and said, you guys can do this. So think that if we'd had a Fuhrer, I have no doubt that psychiatry would have leaped in. They were champing at the bit in 1942, writing an editorial on behalf of the American Psychiatric Association, calling the extermination of five-year-old retarded children. But I also think that America has certain principles that other nations have not had that are embodied in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and I think that that's somewhat of a protection. You and I may differ about that, but I do think our Bill of Rights and our Constitution represent individual liberty above all things, and that that's somewhat of a protection when you have a society where a large part of the culture believes in fundamental human rights and God-given human rights. And psychiatry has never promoted human rights. It's always been a cutting-edge oppressor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, so, Jeff,
absolutely.
Five or six more minutes.
Well, I totally agree with this. You know, maybe we could say just a few words about Jung in this context, because as far as I know, Jung was not aware or didn't care or didn't take any position on this. But, I became very interested in Jung's anti-Semitism. I just find it very bizarre, Peter, that there are so many Jewish Jungian psychoanalysts. And whenever I meet one, the first thing I say to him is, well, how do you square that with the things that Jung said about Hitler? And they're always very defensive about this. A couple of them are not. A couple of them acknowledge, yes, he did this. I mean, there's just no question. You know, he did a radio show, Jung, in Berlin in 1933, like what we're doing, and he praised Hitler then. And somebody raised the question, well, you know, but Hitler is our leader. And they said, well, and Jung said, and I quote here, nobility by its very nature believes in blood and racial exclusivity. And, you know, that's just code for get rid of the Jews. There's absolutely no question of that. And in 1936, when he wrote about Wotan, who's the god of battle lust, he thought this was Germanic and that the Jews did not have it. And in 1939, he said, Hitler is a seer. S-E-E-R, not somebody who sees, but a sage. And he even told that he was friendly, strangely enough, with Rabbi Leo Beck, who later became very famous, a friend of Roosevelt. And Jung told Leo Beck that Mussolini, Hitler, and Franco were all archetypal religious figures. So, you know, after the war, of course, he said, oh, I never believed any of that. You know, terrible. I mean, I tried to warn people about Hitler. He did nothing of the kind. So he was a tremendous hypocrite, Jung. I mean, you know, I've criticized Freud a lot, but compared to Jung, Freud was a mensch.
Oh, God. Two thoughts on Jung. One is that he was a psychiatrist. And a lot of the people
was,
who surrounded Freud were not psychiatrists. And so he comes from that biological tradition. I think the second thing is that Jung is, I think, a religious figure to people. And that's why things can be overlooked and forgiven, both because he's a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, but he also, with a lot of his mystical kinds of concepts, I think is a kind of a spiritual leader to people. Jeff, let me take a minute and read very quickly a couple of the comments on the fact that the Holocaust might not have happened without the psychiatrists. Mitrelik, I can't pronounce his name correctly, who you mentioned earlier in the book, he wrote that this program became the starting point for a line of development that inexorably led to enforced mercy death for the incurably insane on the one hand, and during the war on the other, to plans for exterminating races declared to be inferior. So the eugenical and then murder program of the mental patients was a part of what grew into the extermination programs. Leo Alexander himself, a horrible human being, which we can talk about on another time, our American psychiatrist, he was a German. He fled Germany. He brought all the worst biological psychiatry to America. And Leo even praised at one time Hitler's eugenical programs. She says, the methods used and personnel trained in the killing centers for the chronically sick, that's really mentally ill, became the nucleus of the much larger centers in the East where the plan to kill all the Jews and Poles and to cut down the Russian population by 30 million. So here's Alexander himself saying that this was the entering wedge in his words. And then finally, physician Andrew Ivey, who is the American Medical Association's official representative at Nuremberg, he said, had the profession, I think the profession of medicine and psychiatry, had the profession taken a strong stand against the mass killing of six Germans before the war, it is conceivable that the entire idea and technique of death factories and genocide would not have taken place. We're into the music. We're getting ready to sign off. My wonderful guest, Jeffrey Mason. We're going to have Jeffrey on again to talk about why we may not want to have a profession of psychotherapy, and he and I will discuss. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you so much.